27 years after the founding of the Premier League, it would be difficult for anyone to argue that it is anything other than a great success story. It's the poster boy for a global, open, free trade in Britain. It's an incredibly successful export business. But players' enormous salaries and transfer fees of hundreds of millions are variously described as obscene, absurd, ludicrous, and even unsustainable. Each year, the amount of money spent is not merely sustained, it zooms upwards. But given that in 1981, fewer than 10 First Division English footballers earned more than £175,000 a year, and the average player now commands 15 times that, are those that long for the post-war world of English football, when footballers were skint and players might only receive £10 as a signing-on fee from a transfer worth about £35,000, longing for the halcyon days of football of a bygone era? Or is this best forgotten about? Especially when you consider that as a result of globalisation and technological advances such as the pay TV market, football has become more popular and so much more profitable. The rights for the first seasons of the Premier League in 1992-97 sold for less than £200 million. The TV rights for 2016-19 were, in comparison, worth more than 5 billion quid. Joining me to discuss the economics of football is the IEA's Director General, Mark Littlewood. Hiya, Mark.
Hi, Dan.
Now, Mark, I want to start by asking you, is it fair that you may be able to shell out the 90 quid to watch Southampton FC play at Wembley, but the overwhelming majority of Satan fans would struggle to catch the game?
This goes to ticket pricing, which is a thorny one. Most of the evidence from football ticket pricing is it isn't actually pitched at the maximising level. Manchester United's games, for example, are complete sellouts. So you would expect that to actually see, they could probably double their ticket prices and still sell out. So I don't think we should assume that football clubs are just completely ravenous at attempting to get the most out of their fans. They seek to reward loyalty. If you've been a long-standing fan or you go to a lot of away games, it's easier for you to get tickets. But is 90 quid for a ticket at a Wembley final? Saints were in the League Cup final a couple of years ago. I don't think that's particularly extravagant. That's sort of what you'd pay for a decent pop concert or to go to the theatre. It's a similar sort of experience. Just like anything else in the world, if there's a price on anything, some people won't be able to afford it. But it's not obvious to me that that's an absurd price. And indeed, as I say, demand usually outstrips supply at the prevailing prices that are offered.
So you think it's justifiable then that a football player can earn more than, say, the Prime Minister?
Oh, not only justifiable, it's completely appropriate. What footballers earn is a reflection of how many mugs like me are willing to throw a vast amount of money at, in my case, going through the agony of watching them play. And the real question is, if there is a huge market in football and people are willing to pay substantial amounts of money to have, say, Sky Sports TV subscriptions, largely for the purpose of watching the Premier League, not exclusively, but that's their principal proposition. If people are willing to pay, what might it be, 30, 40, 50 quid or more to go to a Premier League game, and if you're looking at tens of thousands at each Premier League game, although television is the more substantial revenue stream, who should get the cash? Who are you actually going there to reward and pay for? Well, obviously, you're paying a certain preset for the upkeep of the stadium and the electricity and all the rest of it. But I'm going there to watch the players. Mm-hmm. That's the entertainment. That's the proposition, really, on the pitch. And why should they not get, to come over all Marxist on you, the full fruits of their labour? The alternative, if back in the bad old days with England 1966 World Cup hero and captain Bobby Moore and sort of getting by on salaries which were capped, is all of the surplus went to the owner. If Manchester United players were only paid £100,000 a year, let's say, still a decent salary, the huge profits in football, or the huge revenues in football, would simply go to whoever owned Manchester United Football Club. Mm. So I would have thought, if you're the sort of person who yearns for a workers' paradise and power to the people, you would be delighted at what's happened on footballers' salaries. They have been amongst the most proficient trade unionists over the last 20 years or so.
But can you really argue that, though, considering that 1.5 million players played in organised English youth football, but only 180 of them will make it as Premier League pros?
But that stands to reason, doesn't it? That's why they're so highly valued, is that, although at the risk of jokes coming in about my own team, I was going to say that you can't merely be an average player in order to make it in the Premier League. But in truth, you actually have to be completely exceptional. You know, most people who play football are not paid for it. Most people who play football go down to the park on a Sunday, jump as a goalpost, kick a ball around, and probably contribute 10 quid to have a referee if they want one. So it is the absolute pinnacle elite talent that you're watching in the Premier League. Not the best 1% of players, but you know, the best 0.01% of players. And that sort of skill always commands a premium. And I think we should, it's a sport obviously, but I think we should think of it like an entertainment business. If you were to make a comparison with, say, pop stars or people in the music business, by and large, most people who play the guitar or tinkle the ivories on a piano are not making any money at all. A good number of them who do make money will be doing small gigs in pubs, barely washing their face. But obviously the mega stars, the Taylor Swifts, the Elton Johns, the Celine Dions, are bringing in millions because they are, by popular acclaim and by people's revealed preferences of where they're going to spend their money, the most popular ones.
I mean, that's clearly true, but isn't the league a lot like, if we give an example of an industry, the supermarket industry, for example? Mm-hmm. Only in the league, there isn't an Aldi or a Lidl that's nipping away at the larger competitors as far as money's concerned. And the only way to break that is to invest huge amounts of cash into it.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, there's a great book by Stefan Szymanski, I think the author is, called Soconomics, which is one of my favourite books of all time because it blends economics and football into one text. So two of my great passions. But Szymanski basically establishes and proves that football is basically a perfectly competitive market. Mm. It's actually not really true to talk about profits. Mm. It's nearly impossible to make a profit actually out of a football club. Some people have, if they've got lucky, if they've bought a club when it's been at a very low ebb and then has managed to get into the Premier League and then they sell it. But by and large, you can't extract a profit because it is so competitive. And there is, I was going to say, an almost exact correlation. That's probably stating it a bit too far, but there's a very close correlation between the number of points that you'll get in the Premier League and the total wage bill of your players. Very, very closely correlated. So if you're trying to eke out a profit by making savings and trying to get by on less well-paid players who are presumably less talented, you'll suffer. Your team will either fail to win the league or fail to qualify for Europe or get relegated. So it has within it, it is highly competitive within the league. And it's worth saying that I guess you could look at English football as something of a monopoly. There is one league structure. There is not there are not competing pyramids. There are not different disciplines of association football. But of course, football competes with other sports and entertainments. I mean, do you want to go to the football, or do you want to go to Wimbledon? Or do you want to watch the cricket? Or do you want to watch the motor racing? So it competes against other entertainments and particularly other sports. Highly competitive, cutthroat business where getting things wrong by 5% simply isn't good enough, ends in disaster.
So would you support something, well, a scheme to encourage competition? Isn't that what the Financial Fair Play Scheme is designed to do?
Yeah, the problem with the Financial Fair Play Scheme, this is to, if you like, ensure, it's supposedly to ensure that clubs don't either run up astronomical debts or that you can't have some unbelievably wealthy individual who sort of just dumps $1 billion on a club and thereby buys the best players in the world and skews the whole thing. That's the theory behind it. And football clubs have a history, actually, of being pretty disastrously run. It is a miracle that football clubs don't go bust as regularly as normal businesses because so many of them run up colossal debts. But the problem with these financial fair play rules is it basically bakes in your present advantage. And if you were to take a modest Premier League team such as the one I support, Southampton, it is now almost inconceivable to dream that Southampton might get into the top four of the Premier League. Because in order to do so, we would probably have to find some unbelievably rich donor who decided he was willing to throw 300 million quid at signing some more players, probably more than that, and that is now prohibited. So there's a danger that financial fair play thing will bake in the advantages of the big established clubs like the Manchester United and the Liverpools and make it increasingly difficult for the smaller teams to compete anywhere close to the top of the league.
So it would all but kill competition, essentially.
Well, I mean, we did obviously have the extraordinary anomaly of Leicester City winning the Premier League recently, mm-hmm. a 5,000-1 shot at the, outside, at the outset of the season, a complete surprise. I'm told the Leicester City players at the end of the season were each given £250,000 as a bonus. That was not a bonus for winning the league, because Leicester City didn't think they had any chance of winning the league. That was the bonus for not being relegated, which they managed to achieve by coming top. But I think if you write off that anomaly, and I think that probably was a 1 in 5,000 year event, there is a danger now that we've got in the Premier League the top six, the two Manchester teams, Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal and Tottenham. And it does seem extremely difficult to consistently break into that top six. Southampton have managed it once in recent years, came sixth. Leicester City did actually top the league. But more or less, you know at the start of the season that those are going to be the top six in the division. And I'm afraid the financial fair play thing will basically put up the drawbridge and favours the incumbents.
You know, there's a... I don't know if you've seen on Netflix, there is a... sort of documentary series that follows Sunderland Football mm-hmm. Club, and there's a lot of fans there talking about how angry they are about the fact that the club at one point had spent extraordinary sums signing up players that they felt weren't really invested in the club, mm-hmm. And they are, you know, they're season ticket holders, they are very much dedicated to the club and feel that they are, I guess, being hard done by. So do you think there's an argument for to keep people like that, to keep the fan base happy, the ones that are actually making the money, for sort of salary caps like you have in domestic sport in America?
It might. I don't think that's a very good reason to do it. Mm. I think there might be some other reasons to consider it. I don't think that you should just say because the average fan earns, I don't know, 25 or 30 grand a year, say, that it's now sort of egregious or immoral that the people that they're watching are earning that in a week or in half a week. I mean, because why would we apply that again uniquely to football? I mean, if you go to an Elton John concert, is it outrageous that he's earning whatever he's earning, £1 million a week, when the people who are listening to his music don't earn that over their lifetime? So that's not a reason for doing it. And I think it's worth saying that with a few exceptions, but very few exceptions, football fans are histrionic whingers about everything, right? I mean, there was actually a study purported to show that being a football fan is actually economically irrational, because you spend quite a lot of money, potentially a vast amount of money, I certainly do, following football, and actually wins don't make you particularly happy.
Well, but you know that better
make
than
you
most.
Very depressed is the scientific evidence. So why are people spending huge amounts of money on a sport that the numbers would suggest bring you misery, not joy?
To put on the record, I support Newcastle United, so it's not exactly...
You've had a few tough fashion, years as well. I don't see why footballers should be singled out. I think they're singled out a bit because football at least has a history of being a working-class sport. It's much more gentrified now. So there's a sort of set... And it still recruits a lot of players from working-class backgrounds. Mm-hmm. But we don't seem to make the same complaints of other very high earners in the entertainment business, or indeed other high earners in other sports. I think Lewis Hamilton earns £45 million a year, something like that. Well, I mean, that's obviously a lot more than people who go to Silverstone to watch him drive his car around the track. So I don't think it should be, I don't think that you should sort of not pay people what they can demand and deserve in the market, or entitled to in the market, sort of in order to appease the fan base. However, I think there is a case for salary caps, but I should make it very clear, this shouldn't be a state law. I mean, this shouldn't be passed through Parliament. This would be the private association of the Football Association or the Premier League deciding what its rules are. Quite often happens in other sports. Formula One, for example, has limits on what you can spend and limits to what you can and can't put on the car, and certain technologies are prohibitive and all of the rest of it. And in American sports, which some people sort of point to and say, ooh, that's surprisingly socialist.
Yeah.
There's a salary cap, but it's actually a private contractual arrangement. And I think one of the things, it would be difficult to transform English football after its long heritage and history, but one of the things that the Americans get right is, to all intents and purposes, isn't legally the case, but to all intents and purposes, if you are an American footballer, you are really working for the NFL, the National Football League, and you're sort of contracted out to one of the clubs, or franchises, as they call them. The clubs are franchises of the league. And in American football, this has had the impact, and there are salary caps. You can sort of, it's quite complicated. You can sort of ring fence a couple of players and pay them a bit more, but you've got to get your overall wage bill down to a particular level. So if you've signed four total superstars, it's likely that the rest of your team will be considerably weaker. Every superstar means that you haven't got as much money to spend on the rest of the team. But the impact, which I think would be more exciting in English football, is in the last 10 years, there have been 8 different winners of the Super Bowl. And that's, every team sort of has a chance, not each season, but over a 10-year period, most fans will have had a season in which either their team won or got to the Super Bowl, or it was close. Not really true in the Premier League. So if we were to go back to 1992 when the Premier League was founded, I'm trying to think of all of the teams that have won it. Two relatively small clubs have won it, Leicester City and Blackburn Rovers. Manchester United have won it, Chelsea have won it, Arsenal have won it, Manchester City have won it. I think that's it. I might be missing, 6 winners in the space of more than a quarter of a century. In America, 8 winners in 10 years. So if you want to make the sport more competitive, and it sounds like special pleading for somebody who supports Southampton Football Club and wants them to do better, obviously, but if you genuinely want more Leicester City-style seasons, not one every 5,000 years, then I think there probably does need to be a way to even out what the mega clubs can spend, because there's just not a cat in hell's chance, really, over the medium term of Southampton ever finishing above Manchester United. It happens once in a blue moon if Manchester United have a terrible season and Southampton have a terrific one, but it doesn't happen often enough. And I actually think football fans would prefer that turnover, that churnover, and at least gives you, even if you don't win anything, the chance to realistically dream, rather than knowing that your team is never realistically going to make it to the Premier League or is at best just going to be in a relegation battle.
Well, do you think then, you mentioned the sort of gentrification of the sport, do you think that if you look back to the sort of what are seen as the halcyon days of the post-war world of football, of English football, when they would receive a tenner as a signing on fee, and now you can see players around the world, thanks to globalisation, generating $600 million alone in transfer fees.
But that's a good sign, isn't it? I mean, I don't really buy this halcyon day stuff. I can't speak to the immediate post-war period, but if you were to... I've been a keen football fan for... going to matches for over 30 years now. And the quality of stadiums has just improved enormously. I mean, again, to speak of my own club, we used to play at the Dell, which had a certain charm to it, but was basically a urine-soaked death hole. I mean, it was pretty grim. I mean, it really was. It was not the place that you would sort of take your family to. It was grungy. The toilets were disgusting. There was no real comfort or luxury. And everybody sort of yearns for these days of sort of standing on those terraces of concrete and even have a seat. And it is true that there was perhaps a more raucous and exciting atmosphere than these slightly sort of Lego kit stadia, which were all perfect, but it was grim. And I mean, I go to the football with my partner, my mother in her 70s now, my father in his 70s. I wouldn't have considered that in the 1980s or even in the 1990s. And if you were to look at, say, football hooliganism, I wouldn't say it's been completely stamped out, but pretty close. The amount of violence, I mean, you know, at some point, on certain occasions, causing the loss of human life.
Yeah.
But even falling short of that, you know, the chance that a fight or a scuffle would break out or somebody would throw a beer glass in a pub was very, very high. It was a pretty edgy, violent atmosphere in very grim Victorian surroundings. And that's been transformed. And I guess that does make me a kind of effete middle-class football theorist. But I actually quite like having a comfortable seat somewhere warm to have a drink at half-time and the ability to actually go to the toilet in a standard toilet rather than sort of up against a wall. So all of that, I think, has actually improved, and people forget how grim it was. And I think there's also a great story about football, although, you know, everybody sort of looks at these sort of playboy millionaires who, you know, drink crystal champagne and have a whole collection of Ferraris. But take the case of Neymar, the Brazilian centre-forward, signed for an absolutely colossal transfer fee when he went to Paris Saint-Germain. But he is a sort of working-class kid made good. There may be a little bit of embellishing about exactly how impoverished his early life was, but his father had three jobs. The family apparently had to often rely on candlelight because they couldn't afford the electricity bill. I mean, really from the slums. The same was partially true also of Pelé. I mean, it was not from an affluent background. Probably not quite as impoverished as Neymar, if you take into account the time difference. But people whose life prospects are, on the face of it, not great, in fact, pretty miserable. Some of them, if they've got the talent to be brilliant footballers, have a route out. And that is a rags-to-riches fairy tale, really. Doesn't mean that we should overlook those people who get stuck in the slums and don't have opportunities, but just because everybody doesn't have the ability or the opportunity, I don't think that we should begrudge or hold back or feel envious about those with sparkling, brilliant talents rising to stardom and colossal fame and riches. Good luck to them, I say.
And raising quite a lot of money for the Exchequer as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, clearly. I mean, these guys are, you know, are top-rate taxpayers. It is fair to say that a good number, especially in Spain, have been in trouble over tax fraud, and there's all sorts of difficult issues about, you know, who owns the marketing rights of a particular player. If your club is selling a lot of shirts with your name on the back, what should be your share of it, and how much is, and where is that paid? Because the globalisation of football now, which has particularly helped the English Premier League, but has also meant that, say, Barcelona Real Madrid will be a pretty heavily watched match in England, which just wouldn't have been broadcast 25 years ago or 30 years ago. Because of the global nature of it, you can make a case that it's not completely obvious where someone is earning their salary. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean, you're obviously kicking the ball around on an identified stadium in England that you can point to with a postcode. But frankly, it's not the people in the stadium like me who are really generating the money. I was just trying to do the calculations for Southampton. I would guess their gate receipts per game are a bit north of £1 million, mm-hmm. about 30,000 people at about 30 quid or so ahead, about £1 million or so. But the TV revenues, and we play 19 home games a season, so that's £19 million in gate receipts, although you've got the upkeep of the stadium and all of that. But Saints will bring in something in the region of £100 million a year from the television rights, mm-hmm. which therefore dwarf the actual revenues that you get from live fans. And of course, those television rights, Sky Sports would still be the biggest consumer of it, but people are watching this in Singapore, Malaysia, China. It's absolutely huge. The United States, I'd say, it's now started to take off, the English Premier League. So could these players actually say, well, I'm sort of actually earning lots of different pots of money in different jurisdictions. This shouldn't really all be taxed in England because I'm really earning quite a lot of the money by being broadcast in the States. But all said and done, we want more high earners in the United Kingdom rather than fewer.
Essentially, the Premier League, you know, ideally, post-Brexit Britain would follow the sort of Premier League model of doing business.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, there's a huge thing here that you do need to bear in mind. I mean, I think that the Premier League have basically got it right, and not just the Premier League as a body. I think the Football Association and other football bodies have helped by cleaning up the game, making it a lot safer, particularly after the Hillsborough disaster. Hooligans are more or less stamped out. They've taken a commercial approach to television. When I was a boy, the Football Association thought it was probably bad for football to be on television.
Right.
That it would deter people from going to matches. There were whole blackouts for seasons. I mean, I think there were a good few seasons in which the only televised game was the FA Cup final. You could not watch the games on television at all. And even after that, there were a very limited number of games on television. Now, you can spend your entire weekend almost watching Premier League games back to back.
So they didn't see the profit motive, or indeed the sort of democratisation element aspect of it.
Sure, they considered, which you know now sounds fanciful and ridiculous, that if you could watch games on television, you wouldn't go to the stadium. Was this, and the television rights were pitiful back then. And the Premier League got this right. They realised this was a product whereby TV revenues would ultimately dwarf the actual gate receipts. I mean, it almost doesn't matter from a business point of view if nobody turns up live to the games. Yeah. I mean, it would be disastrous for the atmosphere. but in raw financial terms, it's the TV rights that have really made this work. And so, yes, I mean, I think that the Premier League has been modern, dynamic, and successful. It's worth bearing in mind, though, that an awful lot of this is historic legacy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't easily establish, I think, new enterprises like this. I mean, you know, it's beginning to take off in America with American teams. Australia's now sort of got its own soccer league. But because of the history and the legacy of the Liverpools and the Arsenals and the Manchester Uniteds, those teams actually have a greater brand loyalty in many parts of the globe than the domestic teams. You'll find Manchester United shirts in virtually every city on planet Earth, and probably a good deal more in some cities than you actually find in Manchester.
Yeah. I want you to summarise, Mark, by saying whether or not you think football or the league is less competitive now, and if so, why?
Mm-hmm. I think it is. If by less competitive, what you mean is more predictable, that you could say with confidence at the start of the season that you can more or less pick the league table. There will be outliers, but it's hard really to get your prediction enormously wrong. I mean, it would be sensational if Manchester United didn't finish in the top seven. I think most football pundits this year correctly predicted, and it wasn't a great deal of insight, I also correctly predicted that the title race would be close between Manchester City and Liverpool, and it is indeed close, but those are the only two teams with a cat in hell's chance of actually winning it. So it is more predictable, and I mean, back in the day, you would see teams like Manchester United relegated from the First Division. That has happened, but there were very few perennials actually in the top division. I think I'm right in saying Everton and Arsenal are the only teams to have been continually in the top division. So the sort of turnover doesn't really happen, that Leicester City anomaly aside. But does that mean it's less competitive or not? I mean, most Premier League games are still pretty competitive. You go into a game with some sort of snowball's chance in hell of winning, you might be as long odds as a 6, 7, or 8 to 1 underdog, but you've got a prayer. I mean, a recent game, Southampton were playing Manchester United away, lost 3-2 in the last couple of minutes, a defeat, but nevertheless, that is a competitive match. This is not 9-0 to Manchester United, and there aren't many 8-0, 9-0 games. I mean, most teams will make quite a fight and a fist of it in general terms, but when aggregated over 38 games, it becomes astonishingly predictable. A smaller team like Southampton, or a team that hasn't had recent success like Newcastle, they pull off the odd upset. Yeah. I think Newcastle beat Manchester City 2-1 earlier this season, but that odd upset is not enough to transform the table over 38 games, where the average comes. You know, basically, you get a reversion to the mean sooner or later. And I that does disappoint me about the sport. Even if I was taking my own team aside, it's just a bit boring.
Yeah.
I loved it when Leicester City won the league, in fact.
But everyone did. Everyone was did. Sort of cheering.
I remember a game late in the season was Leicester City against Southampton. And sort of I wanted Leicester City to win. Yeah. Southampton were already safe, but I wanted Leicester City to win the league. But with that majestic mad year aside, there isn't enough of it. And intriguingly, and I think it's a pity, the domestic cup competitions no longer have the lustre, the grandeur, or the popularity that they used to have. When I was a boy, more or less, winning the FA Cup was considered about as prestigious as winning the league.
Mm.
A little less prestigious, but not hugely prestigious, hugely less prestigious. So Southampton winning the FA Cup in 1976 was sort of being treated as almost as if Southampton won the league. Now the FA Cup isn't treated as anything like as seriously. In fact, FA Cup games don't typically sell out. So the Premier League has become the juggernaut competition, not just football, the Premier League itself, rather than the cup competitions. And the cup competitions are where you can get upsets. I mean, usually it ends up being one of the big teams winning, but you've got a much better chance as a Newcastle or a Southampton of winning six games, or at least winning five and getting to the final. Over 38 games, you're never going to really catch the big club.
Which is surely more exciting for your ordinary fan, isn't it? If you've actually got a prospect, of course you're not going to win every single match, and no one expects you to. But when it's so stale, every single you can, so you, as you've just said, you know, you can, you don't have to be Mystic Meg to tell
the top,
you know,
six
exactly.
No, that is a problem. I mean, I wonder whether over the longer term you get a bit more turnover. I mean, if you were to look at Manchester City now, who I think will probably win the league this season, but you know, for recent years have definitely been one of the hot teams. But if you were to look at Manchester City over the last 20 or 30 years, I mean, until this money came in, they were a disaster story.
Yeah.
I mean, they went all the way down to the third division. They nearly didn't get out of the third division. They nearly lost the playoff final to get back up. I mean, they were sort of a bit of a joke team, really. I mean, they were very strong back in the 50s and the 60s, I think. But they've only returned to glory, you know, in the last decade or so. So I wonder whether other teams might do that. I mean, I'm looking at how calcified the top of the league is in too short-term a manner. If you were to look at, for example, Wolverhampton Wanderers, again, a great team of the 1950s who've been sort of just sort of bubbling around, sometimes in the Premier Division, most often, I think, in the Second Division. But they look really good this season. It doesn't look like a one-off. I think they're, as we speak, sitting seventh in the Premier League, some way off the top six. But it wouldn't be preposterous to imagine that maybe over a 5 or 10 year period that they break into that oligopoly at the top. So it can be done. I just wish it was a bit more rapid fire, like you get in American sports, that if you have a bad season, then you can recover from it quickly and perhaps have a great season the next year. So that turnover would make it more exciting. But it is still the beautiful game and by far and away the most exciting sport on planet Earth.
Definitely. Cheers for joining, Mark.
Thanks, Aaron.
For more podcasts, films and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.